Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, July 22, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, where today we'll be discussing the recent activities at the Department of Labor. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording today's call for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome two experts to today's call. They are Alexander J. Pasentino. He's with the law firm of Seifert and Shaw right here in Washington, D.C., and he's joined by Paul DeCamp of Jackson Lewis, in the Northern Virginia office of Jackson Lewis. We normally have opening remarks from each, but today what we're going to do is proceed to discuss a number of topics. I'll lead our experts through a number of topics by asking them some questions. But as always, we'll be open to questions from the audience here in a few minutes. So please do be thinking of any questions you have. We're going to try and get through, as I mentioned, a number of topics. So we'll be holding all the questions on all the topics until the conclusion of the call. Mr. Pasentino, the Department of Labor has recently come out with some new overtime regulations that have made a lot of gotten a lot of press, gotten a lot of discussion, even in some of the mainstream media. They seem to have probably a fairly large impact. But if you could, for those of us who don't practice in the area, give us some background, describe what the regulations do, what their impact is, and why they're important and should be of importance to our members.
Sure. Thanks, Dean. As you mentioned, back on July 6th, the department published a notice of proposed rulemaking in the Federal Register, giving everybody 60 days to comment on their proposals. So these are just proposed rules, but you're right, it was exciting back around the first part of July for those of us in the wage and hour world to have our issues front and center in some of the mainstream media. What the proposal would do is increase the salary level for exemption. So what this proposal relates to is there are certain classifications of employees that we shorthand as the white-collar exemptions who are exempt from the overtime provisions of the Fair Labor Standards Act. So ordinarily, they'd have to be paid time and a half for the hours they work in excess of 40 hours in a work week. This is an exemption from that rule, and in order to qualify for that exemption, the employee has to be paid a salary, that salary has to be paid at a particular level, and they have to perform certain job duties. This proposal would increase the salary level required for that exemption from the current standard of $455 per week to, right now, it would be $921 in 2015, and the current proposal is to index that number to the 40th percentile of all salaried wage earners, which would, in 2016, the estimate is that that would be $970 per week. So the thrust of the proposal is that this minimum salary required to take advantage of the exemption would more than double. It would be the federal standard would leapfrog New York. It would leapfrog California. It would require that every employer in every state take a look at these exempt employees and determine whether and what to do. They, you know, there are options on how you handle it. I think the department lays them out in the proposal. You know, some employees are going to get raises to get to the new level. Some employees are going to be converted to hourly and be paid overtime. Exactly how that breaks down, I think, depends on the specific employer, the specific position, and you know, what the economics of that decision are for that particular employer. In addition to the salary increase, they have proposed an increase to the salary level for what are known as highly compensated employees. And for highly compensated employees, the current standard is $100,000. That exemption is basically allows a lessened duties test, a smaller duties test, a shorter, more easily met duties test in exchange for the higher compensation. That number is currently 100,000. It would go up to about 122,000 in 2015. And for whatever reason, the department did not estimate what that would be in 2016, which is when I think these rules will ultimately go to final status. The department also, in this proposal, sought input on the specific methodology for indexing the salary. So this is the first time that the department is actually seeking to index the salary, meaning that it'll go up automatically without any notice and comment rulemaking. It just, as a result of this proposal, if it goes final, the salary will automatically adjust in the method that they include in the final rule. They proposed two methodologies for doing so. One is to permanently index it to the 40th percentile of all full-time salaried wage earners. And then the second is to index it to the CPIU, the Consumer Price Index for Urban. They requested comments on both of those and sought input on both of those. And then the final thing that happened, or that the department did or didn't do actually in the rule, in the proposed rule, is make any specific proposals with respect to the duties test. So what I said earlier is that you have to be paid a salary, you've got to meet these duties tests. And I think everyone involved in this process leading up to the proposal expected something on duties test, expected the department to make it more difficult for employers to meet the duties test, whether, and we're going to get in the weeds for those of you who aren't familiar with these issues, but whether to require that an employee spend more than 50% of his or her time on exempt duties in order to qualify for the exemption, which is not the case now. So that was probably the most feared proposal. And then there are other elements that I think we all had concerns on that they would propose in a duties test, a revised duties test. The department did not make any proposal. They did not propose any language. They didn't make any specific proposal. Basically, what they did is ask the same questions that they have been asking in meetings with the regulated community for the past 14 months. They basically asked the same questions in the preamble to the NPRM, throwing it out there to the world to comment on and provide input. So that's what the proposal contains, kind of what the impacts are. Can't remember what the last part of your question was.
Well, why it's important to the Federalist Society members, and I think you've covered that well. Before we move on to our second topic, let me ask a couple quick questions, if I could. First, what are the next steps? What's the time frame moving forward on this proposed rule?
So as of right now, the comment period will end on September 4th. It's a 60-day comment period. I found it, basically is summer. The rule was published in the Federal Register on the first business day after the 4th of July, and the comment period will close on the last business day before Labor Day. So it just occupies the summer to get our comments in and respond to the department's request. And after that, the department will obviously review the comments. And at some point in 2016, we'll publish a final rule in the Federal Register.
And
I would say, early summer at the very earliest.
And this is Dean with just one final question, another quickie, I think. Does this apply purportedly to all employers, or is it for employers that employ more than 50 employees, or is there any sort of limitation on the businesses it applies to?
It applies to basically all employers. There are the requirement is that the employer be engaged in interstate commerce through $500,000 of business and have two or more employees.
Right.
So basically every employer is subject to this. They're going to be very, limited instances when these rules would not apply.
Terrific. Well, thank you. Let's move on now to Paul DeCamp. I wanted to ask about the Ninth Circuit oral arguments on the tip credit regulations, which I sort of style as a battle between the judicial branch and the executive branch. But let's get your thoughts on that, if we could, Mr. DeCamp.
Well, sure. Thanks, Dean. I'm not going to get into the weeds about the substantive wage and hour issue involved in the case. I don't know how many people on the call would find that at all interesting. If you're following tip credit litigation and you have employees who receive tips, it may be marginally of interest to you. We can talk offline. But what is interesting about the case, I think, and it involves Section 3M of the Fair Labor Standards Act, what's interesting about it is structurally the way the dispute arose. In 2010, the Ninth Circuit issued a decision, and in that decision, it said the statute, this particular section of the statute, means a certain thing. In essence, what it said is if you're an employer and you pay your employees, all of them get at least minimum wage, full minimum wage and cash wages, then it's okay to have a tip pool that includes people who work in the kitchen. So, you know, cooks, dishwashers, that sort of person. The Department of Labor didn't like that. And they said, no, we disagree with the Ninth Circuit. And so in 2011, they issued a regulation saying we don't agree with the Ninth Circuit's plain meaning interpretation of the statute, because what the Ninth Circuit did in its case was it said about four different times that this is the plain meaning of the statute. It's not an ambiguous statute. You know, when you read the words, it has exactly one meaning, and this is what it means. The Department of Labor issued a regulation trying to overturn that, saying we disagree. In fact, we think that even if you're paying all your people full minimum wage, you cannot have a tip pool, a mandatory tip pool, that includes people in the back of the house, in the kitchen. And that was the regulation that they issued. Well, we put together a coalition of plaintiffs, including a number of restaurant associations and a restaurant and a server in that restaurant, and we brought a deck relief action against the Department of Labor and the Wage Hour Administrator and everybody else you see when you bring one of those cases. And we filed that in the same district court where the original Ninth Circuit case originated, up in Oregon. And the district court, there were cross motions for summary judgment, and the court granted our motion and invalidated the regulations. And so the government appealed to the Ninth Circuit. In the interim, a number of other courts, district courts across the country, had weighed in on this same issue, basically following the ruling from our court in the district court. And every court that has looked at this so far has said these regulations are invalid. As an agency, you can't just come in after the fact and say you disagree with a judicial construction of a statute if that construction is clear. So one of those cases happened also within the Ninth Circuit in the District of Nevada. And so this is a case involving Wynn casinos and hotels. And so these two cases ended up on appeal before the same panel in the Ninth Circuit, and we had the oral argument. And it was very interesting to watch because one of the judges from the original case, the original 2010 Ninth Circuit case, was on our panel. And he had very strong views about what that original case meant and about the government's lack of authority to issue regulations undoing the work he did 5 years ago. So that was kind of fun to watch. And the argument's actually available on YouTube if anybody wants to see it. And at the same time, there was another judge who's been on the court, he's been on the federal judiciary since the Johnson administration, and he had different views of the matter. And then there was a third judge who was an Obama appointee who's been on the court about a year, and his views were somewhere in between. And so it made for a very interesting dynamic. I think that one of the judges was all over one set of parties, another judge was all over the other set of parties, and then the recent appointee was asking pretty good questions of both sides. You know, we'll see what happens in terms of what the court does. But it really gets to this issue of what is an agency's authority to issue regulations that are different from a judicial construction of a statute. There's a body of case law on this. There's a Supreme Court decision called Brand X. There's circuit case law on it. And it is really interesting. And you couple that with the notion that a panel of a court is not supposed to overrule or disregard a prior panel decision, that a prior panel decision can only be undone by an en banc court. And so it'll be interesting kind of structurally to see how the judges on that court approach this issue and what ways each of the judges vote in the case. It was a lot of fun to do the argument. Again, they had us share argument time. So the two cases, you know, each side basically got 20 minutes, so double the normal argument time, and we just split the time. So Gene Scalia was arguing the case on behalf of Wynn. I argued the case on behalf of the plaintiffs in our case in the deck relief action. And then you had the Department of Justice, who defends litigation like this for the Department of Labor. You had Justice arguing, and then you had the plaintiff's lawyer in Gene's case. So it was really a fun and interesting argument. But I think if things work the way they ought to, the department really ought to get slapped down for doing really an overreach and going beyond what an agency is supposed to do when a court has said what a statute means.
And let me ask a quick question. This is Dean again. Any sense of when the case will be decided?
Sometime in the next 2 months to 3 years.
That's a pretty big window.
Not trying to be glib about it. I think we're likely to see something in the next 3 to 6 months, but it's predicting when the Ninth Circuit is going to do anything is, I think, a risky endeavor.
Okay. Very good. As I mentioned at the outset, if you joined us late, we're going to be getting to audience questions momentarily, but we wanted to tee up a number of issues. We've covered the overtime regs. We've now covered the tip case. We're going to move now to something else that's been in the news quite a bit, and that's the new guidance on independent contractors. This is, I guess, an administrator's interpretation is what it's technically called, and we're going to hear from, I think, is it Paul DeCamp? Paul, are you going to talk about this one?
Sure, I'll start, and I'm sure Alex may have some things to add to this as well. This issue has been in the news for years now, and it's trying to figure out under the Fair Labor Standards Act, as well as under a bunch of other federal laws and state laws, frankly, where do you draw the line between who's an employee and who's an independent contractor? It's a challenging thing. Congress has been wrestling with this issue since at least 1978. They put a provision in the tax code that was meant to be a two-year stopgap so that Congress could look at that issue, and at the end of this two-year period, which would hopefully expire in 1980, they could issue definitive statutory guidance drawing the line conclusively between employees and independent contractors. Of course, that didn't happen. It's 35 years later after they thought they would have this problem solved, and they're no closer to solving it than they were when they started. And so what we see now is in most working environments, it's pretty clear. It's perfectly clear in most situations who's an employee and who is an independent contractor. But there are certain industries where it is persistently difficult to draw these lines, construction, janitorial, healthcare. There's a bunch that come up. And so what we saw the department do is they issued an administrator's interpretation, which is just a guidance document that the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division signs off on saying, this is our view of the law. And in that view, or in the administrator's interpretation, they articulated a view of who is an independent contractor versus who is an employee that was really kind of strange. In one way, when you take a step back and look at what they did, I think they basically grabbed all the cases they could find where courts ruled in favor of plaintiffs in claims where people who are classified as independent contractors were suing and saying that they should have been treated as employees. And they gathered all these cases and they pulled out quotes that they liked and they just cited the cases that went one way. And from those cases, they purported to distill a series of principles that help you weigh whether somebody is or is not an employee or an independent contractor. The part of what's tricky about that, too, is they would change some words here and there in terms of the standard they would try to distill from the cases. And so in some instances, they were drawing pretty heavily from the cases. But in other instances, they just kind of misstated what the courts said. But that is the standard that the department has issued now. And the other thing that's really challenging about looking at this administrator's interpretation is I don't think it helps you solve any close case. I think if you try to apply that administrator's interpretation in any hard case, in any non-obvious case, it doesn't tell you the answer. It just has these very general principles and tells you here's a multi-factor test. No one factor is dispositive. You have to weigh all of the facts and circumstances, which is essentially useless. But it's at least an indicator of what the department is thinking these days on these issues. Certainly, in every piece of independent contractor litigation that's out there, one side or the other or both is going to cite this document and try to get the court to find something persuasive in it. So it's going to be relevant in that sense. But I don't think it actually sheds any light on anything. Maybe I'm being too cynical. I don't know. Alex, do you have thoughts on that?
No, I agree. When it came out and I reviewed it, you look at it and I just don't think it's at all helpful in exactly the situation you described. When companies are trying to make these decisions and they're trying to make decisions on the close calls, this it's not helpful at all. The main takeaway for a lot of small businesses that I've heard from so far is this mistaken belief that simply requiring all of their independent contractors to go out and get LLCs instead of operating as independent businesses, in their own name. That seems to be the main takeaway that I'm hearing out there, which clearly is not what was intended by the AI, and I think is, it's a bad result. It's going to cause a lot more problems that way, but that's what people have heard out of it. I do think that you're right, that the key use of the document is going to be in litigation, and we'll see.
Very good. Our next topic is the home companion workers regs and what's been happening in the D.C. District Court of Appeals, or District Court, D.C. District Court, sorry. I'm not sure which one of you is able to talk first about that, but that's our next topic.
Either way, I'm happy to kick that off.
Please go right off.
Okay. Basically, the issue here is this companionship services exemption. You may remember the Supreme Court case a few years back, Long Island Care at Home against Koch, which involves a pretty technical issue under the Fair Labor Standards Act and its regulations. Basically, the issue is whether, we've got these employees that go to people's homes we've got these individuals who go to people's homes and they're not rendering medical care, but you've got people who maybe are infirm because they're physically disabled or they're elderly and they have difficulty, showering and going to the bathroom, and they need somebody to kind of keep them company. And so there is this industry of people who go into these homes and, again, not providing skilled medical care, but more companionship services and assistance with daily activities. The technical issue in the law here is there is an exemption from overtime and minimum wage under the law for those workers, and the department has, or for a while had, conflicting regulations about whether that exemption applied only to individuals who were hired directly by the family of the person receiving the services or by that individual himself, or instead whether they were hired by a third party like an agency, for example, or an insurance company. And the department for a while took the position that it was fine if they were hired by a third party. There were conflicting interpretations of the regulations, went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court went with what at the time was the department's interpretation of the regulations and said that employment by third parties is fine. The exemption covers those people as well. Well, the department now has done a 180 on this, and they issued regulations that not only say that employment by third parties is excluded under the exemption, but also there are lots of types of care that if employees are providing that type of care, they're outside the scope of the duties that qualify for this exemption. The district court, so people brought a declaratory relief action challenging those regulations, saying they were basically conflicted with the statute. And the district court agreed and said that the department doesn't have the authority structurally to write regulations that are so narrow that they basically negate an exemption that Congress created, because they said that the number of employees and the scope of services that would be covered by the exemption as the department now wants to construe it is so small that it just doesn't make any sense. Congress couldn't have intended such an absurd result. They struck the regulations. That's gone up on appeal to the D.C. Circuit. The oral argument has been held, and now we are expecting a decision at any time. So that's the issue.
Terrific. Mr. Pesentino, do you have anything on this issue you want to mention?
No, other than, notwithstanding the fact that the district court vacated the regulation related to third parties, I actually got a call from someone today where there is a wage and hour investigator telling them that they cannot take advantage of this exemption because it's being paid by a third party. So it seems like the field is enforcing the rule, even though it's clearly not in effect at this time.
Well, we've we've got a lot on the table. Why don't we turn now to the audience and see what's on their minds? In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question on any of these topics, and presumably our experts are willing to answer questions on other topics as well, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. Before we take our first call of the day, let me make an announcement about upcoming calls. Tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be talking about crime and politics. That's the use of criminal sanctions to investigate folks running for office or folks in office. That's tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. Today we're covering a lot of activity by the Department of Labor. We've got two experts on the line. It looks like we got three questions to get us started. So with that, let's go to our first caller.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. This is Betsy Dormany. Nice to hear you both and to hear your discussion. And Dean, thank you for another very thought-provoking topic. This death of deference business has been something that's interested me for quite a while because, particularly in the labor and employment area, we see a pattern of administrative overreach and the courts doubling back to say, no, maybe not quite so fast. I wonder if you would comment on the latest pronouncement coming out of our friends at the EEOC to the extent that Title VII covers a lot more sex than we ever thought it did before, even in the Federal Court of Appeals, and particularly the Supreme Court. We'll see what they think later. But I wonder if you'd like to comment on those examples of this pattern of regulatory overreach.
Sure. This is Paul. I'll start off on this. I think that for the agencies, they can only do this and they only try to engage in this kind of thing when they have reason to believe that the courts are going to be a willing accomplice. And I think that especially in the EEOC's case, they understand that there is, the wind's at their back a little bit in the courts on the gender issues and being able to pursue broader interpretations of Title VII than might otherwise be consistent with the case law. So I think they're emboldened by that. They see the courts essentially making policy, and they figure, hey, let's do that too. We don't need to wait for statutory changes. The court's going to do our work for us. So if we take broader positions, then maybe the courts will back us up, and we don't need to wait for Congress to act. So I think on the EEOC side, I think that's really what's going on. We can talk more broadly about the issue. I mean, the Department of Labor does the same thing, but sometimes the department is, in some ways more like the NLRB. The NLRB, for decades now, courts have been talking about how the board kind of goes off the rails and does its own thing. They get reversed at a pretty high rate in the courts of appeals. And when one court strikes them down, they'll still take that same position in court after court until they kind of run out of space on the map. Or if they can get a split, then they try to take it up to the Supremes. The Department of Labor is a little bit like that. The Ninth Circuit gave them an answer to a question. They didn't like it. They said, well, we disagree. Now, it's always been the case that agencies have been free not to acquiesce in necessarily the first, court that comes along and issues a decision. But at some point, enough's enough. And I think that some of these agencies, like in the Department of Labor and in the NLRB, they know that there are some judges out there that want to rule the way they want to rule, that they want to advance policy the way the agency wants to advance policy. And they know if the cases get in the right hands, they draw the right panel. The Supreme Court can only take so many cases. So I think they're relying on judges somewhere enforcing what they want to do.
Well, this is a broader question for follow-up. Do you think there's any way for the Supreme Court to articulate some kind of rule that says agencies don't go trying to expand beyond what court decisions are out there? I'm not sure there is a way to do that, although it would be interesting if the Supreme Court would opine on some of these things.
it's hard to know how to square that with the Administrative Procedure Act, right? Because the Act certainly contemplates that agencies, at least if they follow certain procedures, you know, will have a range of authority to act. And then you come down to, well, is what the agency did consistent with what the statute did? I think in what, you know, with what the EEOC has done here, that's arguably untethered to the statute. You know, maybe it rests in some sense on constitutional principles, newly found constitutional principles. But so that strikes me as maybe a little bit different. But it really comes down to whether courts are going to construe agency authority very broadly in terms of, is there a gap in the statute that Congress intended to delegate some kind of, you know, decision-making authority to, or are they going to construe the gaps very narrowly? And what kind of authority are we going to presume in the absence of a clear congressional mandate in a statute for an agency to act? I mean, it's a big issue. It's one that is certainly very important in the courts. And I think we could, depending on, you know, what the configuration of the Supreme Court is when the issue comes before them, we could see justices writing an opinion that would really dramatically pull back on what, at least what kind of deference we're going to give to agency pronouncements. There are certainly some members of the Supreme Court, at least three or four, who believe that the current level of deference to agency pronouncements is too high. And that agencies, in effect, get rewarded for issuing ambiguous regulations and whatnot. And so I think that there's certainly some sentiment, some considerable sentiment on the court to pull back from where the court has been in deferring to agencies. But I would be surprised if we saw kind of a large sea change that says that agencies can't, you know, act in ways that are inconsistent with what some of the courts have said. It's hard to know because you don't want to let the first court that gets an issue anywhere in the country write the law for the entire country either, right? I mean, and maybe we do depending on which court gets the issue, but there are plenty of courts that we would not want to have the last word on these issues either. And so it's tough to know where to strike that balance.
Well, maybe they'll take another look at Chevron. Thanks.
That could be in the offing. Alex Pesentino, do you want to jump in here? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly the Supreme Court and I think courts around the country, they get it. I mean, they understand that the days of the career staff at a federal agency really driving, taking advantage of their expertise on the issue are long gone and that it really comes down to politics in a lot of ways. I mean, there's that Seventh Circuit decision I'm drawing a blank on what it is, but it specifically calls out the issue and says, well, it was this in one administration, and the department's position was this in another, and this in another, and it just flips back and forth depending on which president is in the White House. It's reading the preamble to the overtime rule. It's hilarious because it just says, well, back in 2004, we made a mistake. And it acts as though it's still the Department of Labor when clearly it's just a political policy decision that they disagree with, but it still has to be written in such a way as to suggest that there's this uniform Department of Labor history. So I think, you know, we are going to see the decreased deference, the death of deference in many ways, because I think judges are recognizing these decisions for what they are. And also, most importantly, Betsy, go dogs.
Thank you.
If you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's now take another call.
Hi, this is Christian Stout from the International Center for Law and Economics. I'm curious about how, in your opinion, the FLA guidelines will play out in the burgeoning sharing economy. We see some of these companies, notably Instacart, trying to preemptively cut this off by classifying some workers as part-time employees. And others like Uber are fighting very bitter court battles on the issue. Do you see an opportunity for wiggle room in these FLA guidelines and, I guess, the accompanying state and other federal guidelines on these issues? Or do you think these FLA guidelines are going to try to keep us stuck in the binary mindset between either you're completely an employee or completely a contractor?
This is Alex. I mean, the cynical part of me thinks that the AI on independent contractors was issued when it was specifically to keep us in that mindset, specifically to go after sharing economy issues and relationships and force those folks into employment, traditional employment scenarios. So, again, it's a guidance document from the Department of Labor. I think it's going to be used, parts of it will be used by both sides in an independent contractor classification case, but, you know, it's going to play out in litigation. It's not the final word on the issue by any stretch of the imagination.
And this is Paul. I mean, I think that's exactly right. One of the big themes from the administration at the Department of Labor and from this wage and hour administrator has been the fissured workplace and the fissured employment relationship. Their view is that the modern economy is moving in a direction that is, for lack of a better terminology, distancing labor from capital and breaking up what would be traditionally the employment relationship into other forms, whether it's franchising or independent contractor relationships or subcontracting or other types of arrangements, part-time staffing, all kinds of things like this that we're seeing today that have lots of good reasons for them. But the department now views that, or at least the political leadership at the department now views that normatively as businesses doing a bad thing, trying to evade their responsibilities, almost in a kind of a natural law sense, responsibilities toward these workers. And that's, I think, what's going on. And with the administrator's interpretation, it's of a piece with that. It's trying to, you know, as Alex said, keep us in that box.
Right. Once again, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We have just one caller question left, and then our lines are wide open. Let's take another call here.
Hi, my name's Ellen Baker. I'm an elected local commissioner in Washington State. And I know this isn't specific to the overtime rule, but it's related. In Washington State, there are NGOs that are lobbying local jurisdictions, both cities and counties, for paid medical leave, which historically is a benefit. And they're also pushing for local regulations, local legislation, establishing minimum wage. Probably everybody's heard about the Seattle case, the $15 an hour. There are a lot of questions in the area about the authority of these small jurisdictions, cities and counties, to impose that sort of thing, and I wondered if there were any cases challenging the Seattle minimum wage or paid medical leave.
Right. Well, this is Paul. I know that there has been litigation, and I think there's some ongoing litigation challenging the Seattle ordinance. I mean, typically this ends up being a matter of state law, state constitutional law, state statutory law in terms of what authority does a local municipality have to issue wage legislation or other types of legislation. And that kind of authority varies very much from state to state. And you know, lack of authority at the local level to do these kinds of things is typically one of the challenges that plays out in this kind of litigation. We also see other types of challenges based on the lines that the particular ordinance will draw. They'll say that it's discriminatory against a particular industry, or it somehow interferes with interstate commerce. There are other types of kind of more federal preemption type arguments that can come into play. But I think the issue you're raising, at least with regard to Washington State, will almost certainly rise or fall based on what the Washington Constitution says and what the Washington statutes say.
We're in a home rule charter county. There are only four in Washington State, I believe, and the home rule charter has a public safety, health, welfare, and morals clause, and that may be a challenge. I don't know.
Okay.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We do have it on the caller. Let's take another call.
Hi, this is Andy Yurko in Southern California. I have a question regarding, is there a standard regarding how you determine if someone is an independent contractor or an employee? If there is one, what is it? It seems to be all over the place.
Okay, well, this is Paul. I mean, the answer is sure. There are lots of standards. Pick one. it's, you know, there lots of the courts of appeals have issued standards. There are standards depending on which statute you're talking about. Are we talking about the Fair Labor Standards Act? Are we talking about ERISA? Are we talking about the National Labor Relations Act? Are we talking about state law? There are lots of different standards, the Internal Revenue Code, and there are lots of different ways to articulate even what purports to be the same standard. Under federal law for the Fair Labor Standards Act, most courts will say they're applying an economic realities test. Sometimes that's a four-factor test. Sometimes it has as many as seven or eight factors. The Department of Labor issued its guidance recently that talks about this issue. The challenge isn't that there isn't a standard. The challenge is that the standard, really, no matter which standard you pick out there, it rarely leads to clear dispositive answers where you can know with some measure of confidence that you're making the right decision. You can always take the conservative approach and say, well, we're just going to err on the side of calling the person an employee, but that, you know, you'll quickly be out of business if your competitors are doing it differently. And so there's a business imperative oftentimes to classify people not as employees, but that can lead to, you know, varying gray areas of risk.
Does the amount of supervision, whether they provide an office or things along those lines, does that still weigh into the problem here?
Alex, you want to take that?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly considered, but I don't think there's any one dispositive factor. It is, as Paul mentioned, you know, there are a wide variety of standards, and even when courts purport to be following the same standards, you could get different results. I'm thinking in particular about the cases on cable installers, Paul, where, you know, one court thought that cable installers were the most technically sophisticated people in the history of mankind, and another court didn't. And it seemed to me that that's what the difference in decision was. One said, yeah, of course they're independent contractors. Another court said, no, of course they're not. So even same facts presented to different judges using the same standard, you could get different results because there is no dispositive factor. It's just a lot of different factors that get weighed against each other, and different judges will give different weight to those factors.
When multi-million dollar litigation hinges on whether your judge is comfortable with a screwdriver and a wrench, that's a bad sign for the economy.
Well, and this is Dean. I was going to – let me make another call for questions, push the star button, and then the pound button if you have a question. Our lines are wide open at this point. It really does sound like employers move forward, at their own peril, since there doesn't seem to be one standard, and even the standards that exist seem fairly fluid from one application to another. I mean, what is an employer to do then? Are they best advised to consider people employees? Do they just engage in some sort of defensible characterization that might hold up in court in case they're ultimately sued? It does cause a lot of uncertainty, I take it.
Employers and businesses generally, they take risk every day. And this is one of those risks that they have to make an informed decision about. Very little that businesses do is perfectly safe. And one thing that we know is not safe is having business practices that give you a cost structure because of your labor that is 15 or 20 or 40% higher than every other competitor in your industry. That's not particularly safe. It may be very compliant, but you'll be out of business and compliant. And so you have to kind of factor in what kind of guidance is there in your specific fact scenario. What are the legal risks? How do you have your business structured? How risky is your practice? What are the business realities you're facing? If it's going to bankrupt you to make a particularly conservative classification decision, then you need to weigh that. I'm not suggesting that any business ought to violate the law. Of course not. But when you're dealing in the gray area, where it's not perfectly clear one way or the other, we live in a real world, and people have to make real world decisions about their level of risk tolerance.
This is Dean again. In exploring a lot of issues of executive branch overreach or putative overreach, I suppose, we've encountered a lot of situations where a regulation seems to have a disproportionate impact on new entrants. So startup businesses or smaller businesses suffer more under the regulatory regime, and the larger businesses, the entrenched businesses, tend not to complain about it. Any of the things we discussed here today, do they sort of in some particular or unique way affect the new entrants or the smaller businesses?
No doubt the overtime, the increase to the salary on the overtime rules will have a disproportionate impact on smaller businesses. And not-for-profits are screaming about the increase. I mean, there are some not-for-profits where the top person, the executive director, makes less than $50,000 a year, and there's little question that that person would satisfy the duties test. So they would have to come up with more money in order to make this person exempt under the rule. So you're looking at, when you look at small businesses, you know, it's the same thing. You've got some of the top people. It's just the nature of the business is they don't pay as much as the big guys do, and raising the salary in the way that they've done or proposed to do in such a dramatic fashion. You know, this is not a small increase. They are more than doubling the existing standard. It is going to make it difficult for those businesses to continue to classify employees as exempt, even when those employees clearly meet the duties part of the test.
And one of the things that the Department of Labor has said in the notice of proposed rulemaking is that they anticipate that if the salary levels go to what the department is projecting, about 1 in 4 of all exempt employees who are subject to these salary basis rules will be rendered non-exempt. Now, that, as Alex mentioned before, some businesses will, for some of those workers, raise them up. If people are at $49,500 for salary now, they're probably going to get a $1,000 raise, get them over that $50,440, and we're okay. But very few businesses are going to take somebody who's at $30,000 or $35,000 and bump them up to $50,000 for their annual salary. So about 1 in 4 are likely to be reclassified. And what that means is 4.6 million people. And the department says that once you start factoring in these annual increases, that over the next 10 years, another 500,000 to a million people who are currently classified as salaried exempt, who are subject to these rules, are going to be rendered non-exempt unless the employers change their compensation in some manner. So this is going to affect a lot of people, and you know, it's going to affect disproportionately businesses in lower wage areas, the South, the Midwest, rural areas, nonprofits, certain industries that tend to pay supervisors. That's really mainly what we're talking about is first tier supervisors or managers, businesses who have a lot of those folks, restaurants, retail, sometimes manufacturing, and lots of other industries like that that have a high headcount and relatively lower skilled first tier supervisors. They're going to be hit especially hard by these changes. And new businesses small new businesses don't typically have in-house seasoned HR staff and legal staff to help them guide them through these issues, right? For most smaller companies, they're making their classification decisions based on word of mouth. What are other people in the industry doing, right? And they're not engaging in this kind of legal analysis. They tend to engage in this kind of analysis after the fact when the Department of Labor shows up or when somebody sues them. And then they have to kind of take a look and say, do we have a problem here? So for a small business, you know, one bad finding from the Department of Labor might make the difference between being, you know, solvent and insolvent. So it's a real problem.
We've got a couple more questions from our audience, so let's turn back to our audience now.
Well, hello, this is Robert Fried with Atkinson Nanelson. I have a unique question given California, where I predominantly practice is generally vague on many things. The one thing we're not vague on is the standard for the exempt status in terms of wages, which is fixed at 2 times the minimum wage. But the new federal standard is without that kind of a solid benchmark. So any comments on that? And by the way, the federal standard will be higher than California. Any comments on that and possibly any challenge to the setting of the standard by the DOL?
Well, California is still worse because of the duties test standard that you have. I think one of the things that the department did here as a justification for the dramatic increase in the salary levels, it said, look, there's a problem. There's a whole lot of litigation out there. And they looked at the statistics about how many thousands of cases are filed each year in federal court asserting misclassification and other wage and hour issues. And they said, we're going to fix that because what's driving this is that the salary levels are too low. But the reality is that they've got it backwards. There's no litigation out there where the issue in dispute is, was somebody paying, you know, the $23,660, which is, you know, the $455 a week, or are they paying that or not? There's no cases giving rise to that issue. The litigation at the federal level is driven by ambiguities in what does it mean to exercise discretion and independent judgment? What does it mean to be an administrative worker versus a production worker? What does it mean to supervise two or more full-time equivalent employees if those folks might be employees of a subcontractor? Okay, so it's the regulations substantively, not the wage levels. But at least that's subject to a primary duty standard where you can at least say, what's the most important thing they do? It's not a perfect test, but it works pretty well. In California, you've got your primarily engaged in standard. I think the fact that in California you've got a benchmark for compensation with your exemptions is helpful. It's clear. The new benchmark, whether we look at the existing benchmark in federal law or the new level, those numbers also are clear. I don't think there is a lot of ambiguity in you're either making $455 a week or you're not. You're either making, you know, $970 a week or you're not. So I don't think that I wouldn't say that California or the federal law would be any better or worse than the other from that standpoint. I think that the real differentiator between the two, at least for now, is the duty standards.
Alex Pasentino, do you want to weigh in here?
No, I think that's right. I think Paul hit it right on the head.
All right. It looks like we have what might be a final question. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
Hi there, Betsy Dormany back again with a little follow-up on the overtime thing. We just wanted to share with you all, we had a conference with some of our clients on this overtime proposal recently, and one of the issues that came up that hasn't really been discussed too much is the impact it has on benefits, because a lot of these smaller employers will provide insurance and so forth for their salaried people, but not their hourly people, and so that may have a pretty big ripple effect on a lot of these practical issues in the workplace. The other little point I wanted to make about how employers can deal with it is the salaried non-exempt is available for some kinds of people, but from what I understand, not available in California, which has decided it does not like that. So that kind of is a little bit of a middle ground, which I guess, do you think the new rules will have any impact on that, or but the benefits angle I think is something that should go into the comments if people are commenting on these.
Oh, no doubt, that's an important piece. Lots of employers have different tiers of benefits, you know, for exempt employees versus non-exempt employees, and changing someone from exempt status to non-exempt status means that they're going to go into that other benefits package, which might not be as fully loaded as the exempt one is. So, yeah, I think that's absolutely right. That's an important economic issue that I don't think the department gave sufficient attention to in their proposal.
Well, and I think related to that, one of the things that I've seen some companies thinking about is we've got employees that are at $46,000, $47,000 a year, $48,000. We don't necessarily want to give them a raise in salary up to, you know, $50,000 plus. But maybe if we, you know, borrow from Peter to give to Paul, we can take some of their benefits, give them lesser benefits, and use that to fund an increase in the salary so that we're not having to just take a hit on that. I think you may see, at least for people who are within that margin of do we bump them up to keep them exempt, they may try to fund some of that through benefits. But I think that also, you know, the point about who's going to be affected by these regulations, what's going to happen to those people? Are these workers that get reclassified going to be better off or worse off? Certainly those who get reclassified who find themselves with a lesser benefits package, right there, they're worse off. I mean, ultimately in the long run, if you look out 12 months, 18 months, 24 months after a reclassification, people who are getting reclassified to non-exempt are going to be making, generally speaking, a lot less money, because most employers are going to set their hourly rate to mirror their current schedule and mirror their current earnings. So somebody's working 50 hours a week, they're going to peg an hourly rate that's going to assume 10 hours of overtime going forward, or some other number of hours of overtime going forward, so that you're getting equivalent productivity and equivalent pay pre-classification and post-reclassification. But what will happen is, for those businesses that see week after week on the payroll that huge line item for overtime, that's a very tempting target to want to look at to manage those costs. And, you know, we've worked with a lot of clients that have reclassified people over the years. And even though most companies will start out with a desire not to hurt any of the workers' pay, they want it to be more or less equivalent before and after the reclassification, over time, those hours end up getting pushed down. It's just like this strong gravitational force, and that's what the FLSA wants, quite frankly. It puts that pressure on employers to reduce the hours, and those hours are going to come down to 40, give or take, eventually. And that means that these employees who had their hourly rates set based on an assumption that they were going to have 5 hours, 10 hours, 15 hours a week of overtime, now all of a sudden that overtime is gone, and that's a huge chunk of their earnings for their week. So these employees that get reclassified eventually are taking a pretty significant pay cut. They may be losing benefits, and now they're punching a clock or filling out a timesheet, and now they've got some manager who's going to have to be pressuring them to make sure they take their lunch break and make sure they take their rest periods in the morning and in the afternoon if you're in those states. I mean, there's a lot that comes into play here, and I don't think any of these workers are going to like it. It's certainly not going to be about workers getting a lot more money. There might be a handful who are within that margin where they get bumped up a little bit, but I think that's going to be a relatively small number of people. It's mostly going to be people who are, in the end, taking a significant pay hit, and the work's going to get reassigned either to other existing employees or to new hires.
Gentlemen, this is Dean. We've got a couple minutes left, and it might be a little late to introduce a new topic, but I want to ask if either of you wants to talk about the companionship exemption regulations that were held invalid a while back by the D.C. District Court and now, are now pending before the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. If either of you can get us in closing out, give us a quick update on that.
I think we touched on that earlier, and I don't know that I have anything to add beyond what happened with the district court and the Court of Appeals. I mean, the Court of Appeals has heard argument, and we're waiting for a decision from the D.C. Circuit. As mentioned, the district court struck the regulations, held that they violated the Administrative Procedure Act. They were contrary to the statute, and contrary to the FLSA. And we are now waiting to see whether, in the meantime, our investigators going to continue to try to enforce the regulations, as Alex mentioned, or what is the circuit going to do? People have different takes on how the oral argument went. And it's always a little risky to try to read tea leaves, and so I'm not going to do that. But, it could be a big deal either way. I think if the D.C. Circuit reverses the district court, I think we're going to see the cost of providing these services to the elderly and the infirm, it's going to really increase pretty dramatically. And I think that is going to result in families taking a hit. It's going to result in less service being provided for these folks who need these services. And it's something to watch pretty closely if you know people who are in those kinds of circumstances, or if you care about people who are in those kinds of circumstances.
Well, gentlemen, you've covered a lot of ground. We've got just a minute left, but let me give you each 30 seconds if you'd like to wrap up or express a final thought. Let's start sort of in the opposite order we began in, with Alex Passantino first.
Sure. Thanks. I think the sum up is the Department of Labor is very active. They're going to continue to be very active, I think, for the duration of the administration. We didn't mention the fact that they're going to do a request for information on non-exempt employees' use of mobile devices. And that's supposed to be coming out in the next month or so. So we'll have yet another document on which we can provide comment. I also suspect that they will look at doing something on the joint employer issue, which we've been talking about for a long time. And I would find it very surprising if the current administrator, David Weil, left his position without putting out some type of guidance on the joint employer issue.
Mr. DeCamp, a final thought?
I agree with all that, and I guess what I would say is if you don't like what the Department of Labor is doing, I guess just wait until the next election or the election after that, and things will flip-flop again. That's just how the department works these days, which is part of why the department is becoming a lot more like the NLRB and finding themselves getting criticized a lot more for being overtly political in their flip-flops.
Well, there is an awful lot at play here, a lot left in sort of an unfolding mode. So it's quite possible we'll invite you both back to cover these same topics again in the near future. But I want to thank you on behalf of the Federalist Society for joining us today. This is a very interesting and wide-ranging discussion. To our audience, I want to thank you as well for dialing in. A reminder that our next scheduled Teleforum conference call is tomorrow at 1 p.m. when we'll be talking about crime and politics. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.